WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When you're depressed, says my guest Andrew Solomon, the meaninglessness of every enterprise and every emotion, the meaninglessness of life itself, becomes self-evident. The only feeling left in this loveless state is insignificance. Solomon is what you might describe as a self-taught expert on the subject of depression. He suffers with it and has had several breakdowns. After one of his recoveries, he plunged himself into research on the condition. Now he's written a new book called The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression. The book recounts his own experiences and those of many men and women he interviewed. It also explains the biology of depression, the latest pharmaceutical and alternative treatments, and how depression is understood and treated in different cultures. Solomon is a contributor to The New Yorker and The New York Times magazine. I asked him if he's found any solace in seeing how widespread depression is or in better understanding the nature of it.
There's been considerable solace in understanding depression better. I think the more one knows about it, the more one feels in control of what happens, and the better informed one is about depression, the more one recognizes what one goes through. The extent of depression was the thing that I think most startled and surprised me as I began working on this book. If you go to parties and say to people that you're writing a book about depression, as long as there's a group of people, everyone laughs. But people begin to take you aside as soon as you're with them one-on-one, and everybody I met has some kind of a depression story, either their own affliction or the afflictions of people who are close to them. It's just the family secret everyone has. It's a universal phenomenon.
I'd like to ask you to describe your experience of depression. Why don't we do the most extreme form of depression, the breakdown, and you've had a couple of them.
I have. I had my first really severe breakdown in about 1994. I had been going along about my life, and I'd been through some things that were quite traumatic and quite difficult, the most striking one being the death of my mother at the end of a long battle with cancer. And I was feeling very down and very blue and rather grief-stricken. I had some additional personal traumas. And then I began to feel really increasingly sad. And then I began to feel sort of numb. And then I began to find that things were just a little bit effortful and that I didn't seem to be able to muster very much emotion about anything. And then things began to become more effortful. And I would get home and have messages on my answering machine, and I would think, all those people, I need to call back all of those people. And I think I have to go out and I have to get things to eat and I have to get through the day. And it all seemed like somehow more than I could manage to do. And I thought that was very strange, but I was still able to keep up a facade of functioning reasonably well. And I assumed that it was just a temporary thing. And I didn't really pay very much attention to it. And then it began to get more severe. And I began to have this feeling of dread and anxiety, which was sort of like the feeling you might have if you had tripped and you were about to fall, that sort of middle-of-the-air feeling before you quite hit the ground. But it was extended, and this feeling of dread got worse and worse, and I began coming home and hearing messages on my answering machine and thinking, not simply that I didn't want to call people back, but that I didn't know how I ever could. I would think, who are those people? How am I ever going to catch up with them? What am I ever going to do? How am I going to... And they were just messages from friends and people who wanted to be in touch. And I would think, I have to get dressed. I have to put on my clothes. I have to put on both socks. I have to put on both shoes. And the whole business of ordinary daily life began to seem so effortful and so overwhelming. And I really didn't understand what was happening to me, but I kept trying to battle through it, still thinking, this doesn't make any sense. This is so weird. And then I became more and more anxious and more null. And I had more and more this feeling that was a mix of sadness and fear until finally I felt I simply couldn't do anything. And I found myself at last lying in bed one day thinking, I can't get up. And I lay there thinking, I can't put the toothpaste on my toothbrush. I can't brush all of my teeth. It just seemed like such an overwhelming task. It seemed much more frightening and much more overwhelming than at this point it seems to me, for example, to come and do an interview on National Public Radio. And I thought, how am I going to get out of bed? And I lay there in bed just shaking with fear and feeling completely unable to do anything and feeling no emotion of any kind except that fear and anxiety. And I thought, I have to call someone. I have to get out of my apartment. And I couldn't reach for the telephone. I lay there staring at the telephone thinking, you just pick it up and you dial. But I simply couldn't do it. And fortunately, someone called me and I said, something has gone terribly, terribly wrong with me. And at that point, I started going to see a psychopharmacologist and trying to do something and begin to emerge.
Now, you say in your book that people are often relieved when a doctor says, your depression is chemically based. When you learned about the biology of depression, was that any comfort to you? Did it make you think, well, now this will be easier to overcome?
Well, certainly when I realized that what I had could be explained in part biologically and that it could be treated in part biologically, that was a great comfort. But as I continued to work on the book and as I continued to work with my own personality and depression, I came to believe that everything about us is to some extent chemically based and that personality is chemically based. And some of the time I think people say depression is chemically based as a sort of way out. I think you can use chemical treatments to ameliorate depression, but I think depression itself is a very complex phenomenon. It's chemically based. It's also a part of who you are and a part of your character.
I'd like you to run through some of the pills, for instance, that you're taking now and what they're supposed to do for you in terms of changing your body chemistry or alleviating panic.
Well, my primary antidepressant now is Effexor, which I expect that I'll be taking for a long time. It manages to keep me from getting to that low level of being genuinely dysfunctional. It does not prevent me from being sad, but it prevents me from getting overwhelmingly sad for absolutely no reason whatsoever in the way I did when I was depressed. Then I also take Buspar, which has a mild anti-anxiety effect. And then I take Wellbutrin, which is helpful in allaying some of the antisexual side effects of the Effexor. I take Zyprexa, which is a mild anti-anxiety drug, which is also used for psychosis, though I don't take it for psychosis. And then I also take Topamax because the Zyprexa tends to cause weight gain, and the Topamax, which is a mood stabilizer, tends to prevent the weight gain. So it's a very delicately balanced cocktail.
You must feel very dependent on these pills and very afraid to not be without them.
I feel very dependent on them, and I sort of hate being dependent on them, but I just feel so relieved every time I look at that handful of pills and think, okay, if I take these, that horrible business of depression won't happen to me again.
Andrew Solomon is my guest, and his new book is called The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression. You say in the beginning of your book that your father has worked most of his life in the pharmaceutical industry, and you don't feel as cynical about the industry as some people do. Some people see the pharmaceutical industry as just this big money-making machine. You describe it as more a combination of idealism and capitalism, and you say that based on knowing your father and other people who work in the industry. I guess I'm interested in hearing a little more about your mixed feelings about the industry.
Well, it seems to me that people are very hard on the pharmaceutical industry simply because it's an industry, because it does marketing, and because it seeks for profit. It seems to me that people are seeking for profit in the plastics industry and the magazine industry and the armaments industry and virtually any other industry that one can name. My experience of people in the pharmaceutical industry is that they're frequently exultant when they come up with a product that will actually effect a cure. And the antidepressants, which have been so important in effecting my own cure from a really terrible and devastating illness, were developed in industry. And when I've talked to people at the National Institutes of Mental Health, they've said the budgets and the dedication to the cause simply didn't exist anywhere except in industry. So what I would say about the pharmaceutical industry is that it's full of people who, yes, are very keen to make a profit, but also people who are making their profit by coming up with products that make people well. And my own father, who was enormously helpful to me during the period of my depression, is someone who I think has been very devoted to the cause of increasing the level of health in the world.
You thank your father in your acknowledgments for giving you life not once but twice. The second time is a reference to how he really saved you during one of your depression breakdowns. I think he started working with antidepressants as a result of your depression?
Yes, he did. He said that he had really had no idea until he saw me coming out of my depression what extraordinary drugs they were. And at the time, because of his work in the pharmaceutical industry, he was aware that there was a product that was being sold in Europe, which had an extremely good reputation in Europe, that was not distributed in the United States. And so he became involved in trying to get that product distributed in the United States. And the company where he works is now its U.S. distributor.
You've had psychiatrists who did talk therapy with you and others who took a more pharmacological approach. Are you still combining the two?
Yes, I am, and I think I will permanently. And my biggest piece of advice to people who are going through a depression is to use a combination of therapies. I think too often people want to take medication and not think too much about their own personalities. I think there's strong statistical evidence now that a combination of talking therapy and medication is much more effective than either one of those treatments alone. I think that when you've had a depression, you really have to come to a new understanding of who you are. I think one of the urgent messages of the Noonday Demon is that depression feels, while you're in it, and is while you're in it, a bleak, empty, barren experience. But in fact, when you've come out of it, there are many lessons that can be learned from depression. It's an enormously intense experience. It involves a kind of emotion that you don't necessarily experience anywhere else in life. And part of what I would like to do is to help people to find, in retrospect, whatever richness or whatever depth can be extracted from depression. And I think going through talking therapy is one of the ways in which you can discover those things about your personality that you might never have known if you hadn't been through this particular devastation.
What's an example of something like that that you discovered after one of your depressions?
I feel like I became a kinder person because of the depression that I'd been through. I became more empathetic. And in addition, I think I discovered a joyfulness about daily life.
Yeah, but at the same time, don't you feel this dread that at any moment the depression might come back?
Yes, there's a constant dread of it. And depression is a cyclical and a recurrent illness. And what we have for depression now are treatments rather than cures. Once you have really serious depression, you're never completely free of it, and you're never away from the shadow of it. So you always have to be prepared for it. And that can be a terrible burden, is a terrible burden. One is always staving it off.
What are some of the things that you feel you get out of talking to a psychiatrist that you wouldn't get if you were just taking drugs?
I think you come to an understanding of what the predisposing factors are to depression, so that when you begin to move toward what might be a depression episode, you can recognize it much better and much more quickly. You can decide whether you ought to increase some of your medications or shift some of your medications or do something about them. You can recognize behaviors of your own that seem to trigger some of your depressive episodes, because a depressive episode usually is linked both to life events and to chemical shifts in the brain. You come to understand yourself better and more profoundly. You understand how you move toward depression in the course of your ordinary life. You recognize the kinds of events that trigger your depression. You learn how to regulate your own emotional life and to have greater control over what happens in your emotional interior so that you can steer clear of depressions. You gain greater and more profound self-knowledge. And I think part of what happens in depression also is that you experience a terrible aloneness. And I think in a really successful therapy, you have not only the company of the therapist, which has a certain value, but you also learn more and more about how to connect deeply and truly and honestly with other people, with the people who are your friends or the people you're married to or the members of your family, and that by learning how to have those connections be more profound, less troubled, and less ambivalent, you develop the kind of connectedness and the kind of absence of aloneness that are extremely useful in staving off the recurrence of depression, and that make it easier if you go into a depression to battle your way back out of it.
Does your particular brand of depression come along with a degree of self-loathing?
When I'm in the depression itself, it absolutely comes with self-loathing. I mean, part of what you experience during a depressive episode is a sense that your life is worthless and has no value. You begin to feel suicidal, and part of that suicidality is thinking, I'm worthless. I'm useless. My life is useless. The world would be just as well if I weren't in it. Yes, absolutely. That's a big part of what happens.
Have you found that talk therapy has helped you through that feeling of hating yourself?
I have found that it's been very helpful in establishing really a rational platform that I can oppose to the emotional feelings that come washing over me. Even if I feel emotionally as though I'm worth nothing, I have a rational piece of my mind which keeps saying, now you know perfectly well that you have great value, that you have people around you, that there are very good reasons to live. I think it's important to have a good base established so that your rational mind retains a certain validity when your emotional mind seems to come washing over it with all of that negativity. And it's part of what I hope the book is able to do, is to give people a sense of how to establish that rational control so that their emotional mind doesn't completely colonize the rest of their brain.
My guest is Andrew Solomon, author of the new book, The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Andrew Solomon is my guest, and he's a contributor to The New Yorker magazine and author of the new book, The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression. And it's not only about his experiences with depression, but it's a history and a cultural overview of depression. Part of your book is devoted to your mother's suicide, and you also wrote a New Yorker article about that. Your mother had ovarian cancer, and she was very, very sick during her final chemotherapy. You describe her mouth as being one big sore. She could hardly eat. She had no strength. She'd become allergic to nearly everything. Life was hell, and she wanted to end it. She asked the family to help her commit suicide and to be with her as she did it. Her plan was to take Secanols and overdose on that, which is what she did. How did she explain wanting to involve you in her suicide, as opposed to just doing it and having you find out about it after the fact?
She said that she didn't want to go through the final indignities of dying in a hospice or in a hospital. She was someone who had always very much cherished dignity and control. At the time that she killed herself, she had been told by doctors that she was not treatable, that she had a clearly terminal cancer, and that she had very little time left to live. So it was a matter of dying only a few months before she would otherwise have died in much more extreme circumstances of pain. And she said that she considered committing suicide all on her own, but she felt that it would be terribly upsetting for us to find her dead and not to know what had really happened and not to understand. And she said she felt she wanted to die quietly and peacefully at home, and she wanted us to feel that we'd been with her at the end and to understand that this was not something she'd done in despair or something she'd done in anger or something she'd done because she couldn't manage to get through what lay ahead of her, but rather something she'd done because she wanted peace and quiet and dignity, and that for her it was the right choice and a happy choice, and that she had things she wanted to say to us right before she went. And indeed, she had an extraordinary death scene, which I describe in the book, which concluded with her looking at my father and my brother and me and saying, "I want you to know that in the course of my life, I have looked for many things, so many things, and all the time, paradise has been in this room with the three of you." And then she closed her eyes for the last time. And it was a very moving and very compelling circumstance. And it was very difficult to watch her die. We didn't exactly assist her. We were just present while she did it. But I think it was probably, for all the trauma that was involved, a better way for me to see her go than to see her emaciated and in pain in a hospital bed, the way that I've seen other friends die of cancer.
You describe your mother as somebody who was always well prepared and often had more than what she needed of something, including the Secanols. So there were a lot of Secanols left over after her suicide. And when you were cleaning up after the suicide, you kept the Secanols, kind of thinking if things ever got too bad for you, you'd have them around. And then your father wondered where they were, and he wanted them for himself in case things ever got too much for him. I just found that kind of interesting.
Interesting is an interesting word to use.
I couldn't figure out the right word. Yeah.
I think that in the immediate aftermath of my mother's death, we all felt this enormous sadness, and that there was a certain sense, in the first place, we all knew how difficult it was to get those Secanols. And so we all thought, well, what if I get cancer?
Difficult even though your father's in the pharmaceutical industry?
Oh, yes. My father wasn't able to get them through being in the pharmaceutical industry.
Okay. But you wanted these as safeties in case you got sick in the same way she got sick.
Exactly. There was a sort of feeling, because we had all spent so much time at that point in hospitals and around deathbeds, of, well, maybe I'm going to get cancer next year and maybe I should have a supply of these just in case. I think we also all felt enormously, enormously sad. And for me, it was in some ways a comfort to think, if things get intolerably out of control, I will have an easy way out. Striking to me that when I was in my terrible depression, even though some of the time I had a lot of suicidal fantasy, I never went and found those pills or tried to get them out or took them. Eventually, in fact, I threw them away. It was...
Wait, did you throw them away in the same way I used to throw away cigarettes in the house when I was stopping smoking?
How did you throw away cigarettes in the house?
Well, when I was stopping smoking, I didn't want anybody's cigarettes around because the temptation was too great. Is that why you threw away the secondals?
I threw away the secondals actually because I had told my father that I didn't have them around anymore. And when I told him that, I did have them around. And then I thought I told a lie and that it wasn't really honest and I thought I'd better get rid of them. No, I threw them away because I decided it wasn't healthy for me to have them sitting around all the time.
Andrew Solomon is the author of The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Andrew Solomon, author of the new book, The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression. It's about the biology of depression, the latest pharmaceutical and alternative treatments, how depression is dealt with in different cultures, and Solomon's own experiences with depression. When we left off, we were talking about his mother's suicide after being ravaged by ovarian cancer and chemotherapy. You quote what your mother said to you just before she died, and she said, "Don't think you're paying me some kind of great tribute. If you let my death become the great event of your life, the best tribute you can pay to me as a mother is to go on and have a good and fulfilling life. Enjoy what you have." That's really beautiful advice. Did you try to follow that?
It took me a while. I mean, as I said, there were a number of life circumstances that precipitated my depression. The loss of my mother, to whom I'd been extremely close, was one. The end of a relationship that I'd been involved with was another. I went through extreme physical pain with a very bad case of kidney stones. There were a whole catalog of other things with which I will not bore our listeners today. They all led into a depression. The depression was very severe, and so there was a period, certainly, when the bad things that had happened to me were the subject of my life. But some people have said to me since, well, how did you fight your way back out of your depression? And how did you get to the point at which you were able to write a book about it? And how did you get to the point at which you were living a life that you found rich and rewarding and interesting? And I have to say those words were in the back of my mind a lot. I felt as though one has a limited number of days on earth and one has to struggle to get to the point at which one lives them well. One of the things that I found astonishing when I was working on this book is that there are some people who have got really relatively slight symptoms by their own description of depression, but whose depression somehow devastates and ruins their lives and becomes the only thing that there is in their lives. And there are other people who have got symptoms that are unbelievably extreme and that are almost intolerably painful, but who somehow, in between episodes and around episodes, manage nonetheless to have lives in which they really connect with other people and lives in which they themselves see considerable value. And I became fascinated by the borderline between personality and illness. Now, I don't particularly hold myself up as an example, but I do hold some of the people who are in the book up as examples of those who are able, one way or another, to have rich lives despite their depression. You can't have a rich life during your depression. And it's a terrible mistake to take someone who's in a depression and say, well, pull yourself together. Life is wonderful. Life is meaningful. Get some of the richness out of life right now, despite what you're going through. But I think it's very important for people who experience depression to spend the time when they're in depression thinking of what complexity life has to offer, and when they begin to come out, to try to grab onto the things that will offer some meaning in their lives. That, I think, is the message of hope that there is in the end in this book.
To just hold on till it's over, till that depression is over.
To hold on till the depression is over, but then when the depression is over, to come to terms with the depression, not to turn your back on it, not to run away from it, and not to allow the shadow of it to take over the rest of your life.
Through your book, you quote several poems about depression. Some of them are from people who you know. Others are from Emily Dickinson, Jane Kenyon. I thought it might be nice if you read us one of your favorites that you've collected.
I think that the one that always seemed to me to be the most compelling description of depression is Emily Dickinson. It's the poem, "I Felt a Funeral in My Brain." I felt a funeral in my brain, and mourners to and fro kept treading, treading, till I thought that sense was breaking through. And when they all were seated, a service like a drum kept beating, beating, till I thought my mind was going numb. And then I heard them lift a box and creak across my soul with those same boots of lead again. Then space began to toll, as if the heavens were a bell and being were an ear, and eye, and silence, some strange race wrecked solitary here. Just then, a plank in reason broke, and I fell down and down and hit a world at every plunge, and finished knowing then. There we are.
I should mention, you know that one by heart. That was not something you read from the page. That one you just know. In writing about your own depression, you talk about how when you're very, very depressed, every minute hurts. And it strikes me as being so similar and at the same time opposite to the whole idea of meditation, where you strive for living exactly in the moment. But you're living exactly in the moment when you're depressed. You say there's no past and there's no future. All there is the pain of the present.
I think that's actually an incredibly good parallel, and I'd never heard it phrased quite that way. One of the people I interviewed said to me that she felt like it was that moment when your fingers get slammed in a car door and you're just stalled forever in that exact instant. But yes, it is a feeling of incredible, constant pain. And you think to yourself, not how am I going to get through the next 20 years, but how am I going to get through the next second of being alive?
In reporting on your own experiences of depression, you write a little bit about how you've had a couple of violent episodes since your first depression. I'm not sure exactly what you did or who you lashed out at, but do you think of that as being a symptom of your depression, a side effect of the drugs, or just something that's inherent in your personality that has only recently started to emerge?
I think of it as being very closely related to depression. You know, one of the popular statistics about depression is that it occurs twice as often in women as in men. And violence, of course, occurs more frequently in men than in women. And I've come to feel that the reason violence occurs more frequently in men is because it's an expression of the depression that men suffer. And I was very surprised. I was very depressed, and something horrible had happened between me and somebody else. And I suddenly felt the sort of the panic and the tension and the anxiety and all of those other emotions and that feeling of being unable to tolerate the moment all rising up to the surface. And to my own astonishment, I found that enormous negative energy burst out of me in a moment of violence, which I think was very uncharacteristic of my personality, as it has always been and as it always is. And I realized that there was a sudden alleviation of some of the tension, because tension is also a great characteristic of depression. And I think that's something that often happens with men. And subsequently, I did some extremely interesting interviews with men who were on probation or who were in jail, in fact, for having abused their wives and having abused other people. And I found that many of them were severely depressed, and that many of them described feelings of anxiety and feelings of dread and feelings of fear that had somehow culminated in acts of extreme violence.
My guest is Andrew Solomon, author of the new book, The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Andrew Solomon, and he's a contributor to The New Yorker magazine and author of the new book, The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression. Something that really amazed me that you say about yourself is during one of your suicidal periods, you started having sex with men you didn't know in the hopes of getting infected with AIDS. You say it's not that you wanted to die of AIDS, you wanted to use AIDS as an excuse to kill yourself. I really found that kind of hard to fathom.
Yes, I've found that a lot of people find that particularly difficult to understand. I had the feeling somehow that people saw me as having a very good life, and that if I just went off and killed myself, people would say, "Why did he do that? What on earth was the reason for it?" And I felt as though I needed an excuse. I needed to have something that people would say, "Oh, well, he had this terrible problem, and that's why he killed himself." You know, the difficulty of depression is that it's so invisible. And people who have depression often say that if I had a broken leg, no one would ask me to dance. But when I have depression, people say to me, "Oh, well, depression, what's really wrong with you? What's really going on that's so terrible?" And I somehow had the idea in my mind, possibly because my mother had taken her own life at the end of a serious terminal illness, that if I had something physically wrong with me that was a serious physical ailment, then I could kill myself and people would say, "Oh, you know, he'd found out that he was getting AIDS, so he decided to kill himself," and it would make more sense to other people. And I was always concerned that if I killed myself, I wanted other people to have something they could explain it to themselves with. And so I thought, well, I'll get myself infected And then I'll be able to leave a note that says, I found out I was infected. I don't want to live this way. And so I've killed myself. And it wouldn't leave everyone so bemused or confused. It's very bad logic. When you're very depressed, your logic gets very confused. But somehow it seemed to me at that time to make sense.
How did you give up on that strategy?
I gave up on it for a couple of reasons. One was that I had had a number of these unsafe encounters, and then I suddenly thought, well, if I am infected, it's conceivable that I would infect someone else, and that wasn't what I wanted to do. And so I stopped partly out of concern for other people. And I also stopped partly because I began to emerge a little bit further from the depression I'd been in, and I thought, wait a minute, I'm not sure that I do want to die. And I thought, I actually kind of hope that I won't die. I don't think I really do want to kill myself. It was the beginning of the life spark reawakening in me. And I was very relieved when 6 months later, I went and had a test and it turned out I hadn't infected myself after all.
You talk about how you want some people to comprehend why you would take your own life. You didn't want them just thinking like, he had a good life. Why did he do that? Did part of that fear that people wouldn't comprehend at all and they think, well, he had a good life, did part of that get back to the fact that your family had been pretty prosperous, money wasn't a problem, you live comfortably by most people's standards, by nearly any standard. And people not only might have been confused by your suicide, but almost resented it, like, well, I should have it so good as he had it.
Well, I've been lucky in that regard. I think depression afflicts people across all kinds of boundaries of class, of culture, of personality type, of social situation. Part of what I did in researching the Noonday Demon was to look at depression in a variety of contexts. Depression among the Greenlandic Inuit, among survivors of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, among the indigent and depressed in the United States, people in trailer parks, all kinds of different contexts. And what I ultimately found was that depression actually afflicts people in every context in very much the same way. The difference, I think, is that if you're somebody who has been fortunate enough to have a life which in its externals appears to be good and comfortable, and you feel really terrible about it, then people say to you, well, why would someone like you feel so bad? And you think, I must have an illness. I'll bet I have depression. If you have a life which has got a lot of bleak, terrible external circumstances, then you think, I feel terrible. I guess it's because my life is so bleak and terrible. So I would say that the thing that was really different in my case was that I had a life which had so many things in it that were so good and so pleasant, and that those were the things that made it easier for me to tell that what I had was an illness. But I would say the things that I primarily would put in that category really were having work that I found interesting and rewarding, having people around me I was very close to, good friendships and close family relationships, and having sufficient prosperity so that I wasn't constantly afflicted by financial problems.
You mentioned that you went to different cultures, different countries, to understand depression there. You went to Cambodia. This is after the killing fields, after Pol Pot had practically performed genocide on his own people. The amazing thing there is that not everybody is depressed, that some people kind of carry on without depression. What are some of the things that your experiences looking at depression in Cambodia made you realize about depression?
Well, one is that I realized that people are incredibly resilient. I mean, I discovered as I looked around at the world that there are some people who are in poverty-stricken countries, who have had entire families die in famine, who have been through the most unbelievable, horrendous circumstances, and who nonetheless absolutely cling to life, who you see sort of doing whatever they can, eating whatever comes to hand just in order to stay alive. And I thought, look at all of the people who commit suicide in the most supportive and prosperous and comfortable societies on earth. There is a difference between the people who are subject to depression and the people who seem not to be subject to depression. But in Cambodia in particular, I had a really amazing experience with a woman who treats depressed people in Cambodia and who described how she worked with survivors of the Khmer Rouge who were severely depressed. And she said she tried to work with them in three stages. She said they all were people whose minds were so crowded with horror that they could barely get up and function. She said there were women who had been through these terrible traumas of the Khmer Rouge period and couldn't take care of their own children because they were simply disabled to the point at which they didn't feed the infants who were sitting next to them. She said, and I tried to teach them three things. She said, first, I tried to teach them to forget. And I did that by asking them to remember what had happened, to talk to me about it, and then to talk about other things so that I could begin to fill up their mind with some other things that would take up some of the space that was taken up with their terrible memories. And then after they had begun to forget, I tried to teach them to work. Sometimes all they would be able to do was to clean up their own houses and maybe to gather firewood in the jungle, she said, whatever it was, but I would teach them to do something so they had something they could start and do and say, this was my thing and I did it today, she said. And then, because I was working with groups of women, mostly in resettlement camps, she said, I taught them to perform manicures and pedicures. And I said, you taught them what? She said, the women of Cambodia who had been through these experiences had been in a country in which half the country turned against the other half of the country. And I taught them to do this because it was a system in which they touched each other's hands and feet in a way that was at once intimate and non-threatening. And in doing that, they began to talk to each other, and they were enjoying the idea that they were being made somehow more beautiful while they did it, she said, and it taught them to begin to open up to other people and to trust again. And when they had learned to forget and to work and to trust, then I tried to teach them that those three activities were not separate, but were part of a single sensibility. And when they had learned that, they were ready to go into the world again. And as I listened to what she was saying, I had a sense that here was a culture that was really quite foreign and quite different from American culture, and a society that had been through enormous traumas, but that the basic building blocks of reconstructing personalities that had been ripped apart by going through such enormous trauma were really quite similar to the ones that people go through using very sophisticated Western techniques of psychotherapy.
Andrew Solomon, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Andrew Solomon is the author of The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression. This is Fresh Air.